It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Barrett. 12 bills that target transgender rights are moving through the state legislature. That's according to the Trans Legislation Tracker.
These bills have the potential to impact how transgender people in Wisconsin participate in sports, use their preferred name and pronouns, and access gender-affirming medical care. And they're particularly focused on trans youth.
At the federal level, President Trump has signed executive orders affecting the lives of transgender people. One seeks to ban access to gender-affirming care for youth under the age of 19.
For a look at how these efforts are affecting people's lives, we're joined by Elise Cayley, president of the Washburn-Shawamigan Bay chapter of PFLAG. That's an organization supporting LGBTQ people and their families. Elise, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Can you talk broadly about how you and people in your community are reacting to bills, to executive orders, to things that are targeting transgender people right now? What does it feel like?
It's a lot of doom scrolling and seeing what's happening next. It's looking at what might be happening and just anytime you have to plan something, figuring out what's the safest way for me to go to the family reunion where my grandmother's ashes are going to be scattered. Well, that reunion and memorial is in Florida. So what do I do? Do I answer the call of nature outside for the whole week I'm down there? Do I go into the women's room where I might pass and where, after all my paperwork says I should be going? Or do I go into the men's room, and which is what the law in Florida demands, and get jumped? And above all, how many of my friends, and especially my husband, are waiting to get gender confirmation health care, and that could be stripped away any day now, you know? And so we're all very, very frightened about that.
Let's talk more about gender affirming health care, which is one of the areas that is being targeted not only at the state level, but the federal level. Mm-hmm. What are the ripple effects? What are the consequences if people can't get access to this care?
You know, the more restrictions there are, the worse healthcare outcomes are going to be, and the more trans people are going to be at physical risk, not merely because the personal health consequences of being stuck in the wrong body are serious and dangerous in and of themselves, but because the possibility of random violence from transphobic people, you know, noticing us. So obviously, everyone should feel comfortable in their own body and should be able to feel good about themselves. That's most important, and doctor after doctor has confirmed that gender dysphoria is real, and trans people who seek the ability to medically transition should be supported. But now we're seeing so many restrictions, especially on those forms of transition care that protect, that give us the best protection from random acts of violence, specifically the attempts to ban care for people below a certain age, which keeps going up. First it's 16, then it's 18, then it's 19, then it's 30. You see where they're going. They're trying to make people wait longer and longer before being able to transition, which, especially for trans women like me, means that later in life it'll be a lot harder for us to be seen as anything other than trans, which can be very dangerous. It's not something we should have to be ashamed of, but the ability to pass can mean the difference between life and death, and often does.
We've talked before about how your community around you in the area, in Washburn-Shawamigan Bay area, has been supportive of you, that
yes,
you feel, you know, you have connections in the community. But it's also a rural area, and I'm wondering, does that add an additional barrier to finding services that support transition?
I think ordinarily it would, but we've got a really good set of clinics in this region, the North Lakes Clinic, and they really have excellent support for trans patients. So I've actually had, you know, much better experiences with them than I had with the doctors who first helped me out, I guess, you know, 10 years ago. But yeah, so I will say the medical experiences I've had here have been the best of my life, but that is definitely not true for everyone in rural areas. Then you have to consider how many people in rural areas rely on Medicaid, not just for gender-affirming care, but for everything. And that has the knock-on effect of much of the healthcare in this region depends on Medicaid dollars. Otherwise, they wouldn't have enough paying patients to be able to stay open. So as Medicaid is threatened for one reason or another, that's a threat to us, not just those of us who use or have used Medicaid or BadgerCare directly, but those of us who just use any healthcare because funding healthcare funds us all.
How is PFLAG in this moment in helping people navigate these times and connect to resources and support systems?
Well, our biggest project right now is scholarships for LGBT and ally students going on to higher education. We know that a lot of particular programs are being cut. We know that a lot of schools are under attack. And we want to make it easier for people who have taken risks for the queer community to go on to school. We've also recently received a very generous donation specifically to fund applicants for tech colleges, which is terrifically important. And, you know, I think, you know, every town needs more LGBT mechanics. Every town needs more LGBT plumbers, you know, so We're over the moon about that and trying to get more people out there. Other than that, we're about to start the season for our LGBT fishing club, Queers on Piers.
I love it. That's amazing. You talk about traveling to Florida, crossing state lines when things could get really difficult for you and scary. Are you hopeful that there will be change in a positive way in the future, in a positive direction, so that crossing state lines isn't potentially harmful?
So I'm afraid I must say no. I don't think it will get better.
Why is that?
Because so many systems of control and oppression depend on people fearing and hating us. Whether that's enforcing the social rules that undergird sexism and male chauvinism, or just general homophobia, or any kind of a devotion to a particular way of living that someone thinks a deity has ordained, it's a lot harder to enforce any of those systems without having someone who you can spread all of these fears around, someone that you can feel good about hurting. And I can't see things getting any better for us or for many of the other people who are in danger now.
Elise, thank you for this conversation. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for the time, Kate. It's always a pleasure. And I just hope everyone can find a place where they can be safe and loved.
That is Elise Cayley, president of the Washburn-Shawamigan Bay chapter of PFLAG, an LGBTQ advocacy organization. Now we'll focus on one component of gender-affirming care, which is voice therapy. The American Speech-Language Hearing Association has come out in opposition to government efforts that restrict access to gender-affirming care and clinicians' ability to provide that care. We're joined now by one such clinician. Maya Braden is a clinical associate professor and speech-language pathologist at UW-Madison. Maya, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Start by explaining, what is gender-affirming vocal care? What does your work involve?
Gender-affirming vocal care is anything that helps people to achieve a voice that is congruent with their gender identity, and that might involve changing the pitch of their voice. It might involve changing the timbre or resonance or qualities of the voice. It can also involve articulation and the way that we pronounce words, the way that we change our vocal intonation up and down, even things such as gestures, word choice, the way we use language, our body language. All of those things could be incorporated into gender-affirming voice. And it really is individualized to each client that we work with. So everyone might have a different path to getting to the voice that is theirs in the end.
I'm curious about this path. Is achieving an authentic voice, is that a journey? Does this work take weeks, years?
Yeah, it's different for everyone, but it's usually not instant. There are strategies that people can adapt pretty quickly, but when you're changing anything that is almost an automatic, if you think about when you talk, when you speak, when you sing, we don't think a lot about exactly how we're doing it. And so when you make changes in that, you might be able to make the changes quickly, but most people find that it takes more time for those to become more natural, more habitual.
And think about how our voice has changed when we heard that little recording on the tape recorder of us singing a song when we are like 3-4 years old. And you think, who is that person? Is that really me? How does a voice change? And what is the impact of like hormones?
Yeah. So I don't know how scientific you want me to get on this, but our voices do change over time. You know, babies have very, very tiny short vocal folds, which means that they vibrate very fast at very high pitches. And as we grow, those vocal folds get longer and thicker, and our necks get longer. And so the vocal folds, as they get bigger and longer, our voice deepens. And when people go through testosterone-influenced puberty, as assigned male at birth usually do, they will have more rapid changes in their pitch right around that 12 to 18 years. It can drop by about an octave. Those who are assigned female at birth don't have as much of a change, but we still do have a slight change, and our voice gets a little bit lower, and also our range expands a little bit as we get older. And then there are other age-related changes that have to do with hormones as we get to midlife and as we age that can change pitch and quality.
Considering the range of services you offer your clients, how is gender-affirming voice therapy similar or different from other types of voice therapy you do?
So we use some of the same techniques, and that's how I came into doing this. So when we're doing voice therapy, for example, for people with vocal injuries, we might do things to modify their resonance, to modify how hard their vocal folds contact when they make sound, how they're using their voices, and those kinds of things. And some of those same strategies might be used for gender-affirming voice as well.
Mm. Do all speech-language pathologists offer these types of services?
No, there is some specialized training and experience that goes into it. So when we graduate with our master's degree, we are officially trained in everything, but at the same time, we are sort of generalists. And then as we go farther into our careers, we all do continuing education every year, and some of us might choose to do more focus in gender-affirming voice or general voice or child language or fluency, all kinds of different areas. And to do gender-affirming voice, you should have additional training beyond just the master's degree in speech-language pathology, but it is part of everyone's scope of practice.
When a person's voice doesn't align with their gender identity or how they want to be perceived to the world, what effect does that have on a person's self-worth and on their quality of life?
Yeah, I mean, it really does. If you think about how much our voice is sort of that external representation of us, anytime our voice doesn't match who we feel we are, it can be extremely distressing. There's research, not a ton looking at quality of life, but there's a paper that just came out recently specifically looking at people's goals in voice and how having that voice that matches their gender identity, that matches their internal voice is really important. And when people don't have that, they can feel internally distressed. There can also be external factors when they are misgendered on the phone or in person, or even feelings of safety. Their actual safety concerns of having a voice that maybe doesn't match you. And we also know that when people are able to make changes in their voice and communication that better aligns with their identity, they often have improved quality of life and improved overall happiness.
So what are the benefits of doing this in a clinical setting versus trying to do this on one's own?
I think there are advantages either way. So, you know, doing it on your own, it's more economical. You can do it on your own time. But a lot of people do find that they feel a little bit lost in that. There are a lot of resources out there. There are a lot of, you know, internet videos. But being able to work with somebody one-on-one to really tailor it to your goals, your voice, make sure that you're doing it in a way that is not just sounding the way you want it to, but feeling good and being healthy and sustainable and not too tiring, I think are some advantages of working one-on-one with somebody.
Can you talk a bit about pitch? One factor that you work with, you know, someone might want their voice to sound higher or lower depending on how they want to express themselves. But what can you do there and to help find, you know, to help them find that pitch?
Yeah. Well, first, I want to say that there is a wide range of pitch that can be identified as male, female, masculine, feminine. You can have two people who have almost exactly the same average pitch who are very, very clearly identifiable as masculine or feminine. So there's quite a bit of overlap. At the same time, usually one of the first things we do is measure someone's current speaking pitch, measure their range, and when we start working on pitch, which is usually not the first thing we work on, when we start working on pitch, we find a pitch that is achievable that fits within that range that is identified as their gender. And so there are some studies that show about 145 hertz is about the lowest average that can be reliably identified as feminine. And I'm probably speaking at about 190 hertz.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah. Is there technology that measures that? Do you have some devices that you use?
Yes, we have fairly fancy devices in the clinic, but there are also free apps. So people often will just download an app onto their phone that will measure their pitch and tell them what their speaking pitch is. And then they can also look at a target and kind of match it to within that range as well.
What is demand like for gender-affirming voice therapy? You've been in this line of work a long time.
Mm-hmm. It's variable. I think there's always demand. I think people, as they find out more about the opportunities for it, there might be increased demand. Most voice clinics within the country do some gender-affirming voice. But I know also the clinic at UW has done it since at least the 1990s, and there's been demand since then.
Gender-affirming care nationwide is under the microscope.
Yeah.
Does that affect how you do your work and how you care for your clients?
I'm going to optimistically say it's not directly affecting my work right now, except in how people are feeling. I think definitely seeing a lot more worry, fear, and if anything, it makes me want to go out and do more of it. But I think... Yeah, I think people are feeling like they're in a lot of ways, under attack and worried about whether those services are still going to be there.
You can hear those emotions in people's voices.
Yes, definitely.
Mm. Maya, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Maya Braden is a clinical associate professor and speech-language pathologist at UW-Madison. We talked about gender-affirming voice therapy and the work of aligning a person's voice with their gender identity to achieve their authentic voice. And earlier, we talked with Elise Cayley, president of the Washburn-Shawamigan Bay PFLAG chapter, about efforts to limit access to gender-affirming healthcare.